Many firms, including Nike, Lululemon, Chevron, and Royal Dutch Shell, declined to make their data available for this study. For example, companies control or influence around 70% of the world's usable water, either through the direct operations or through their supply chains. Well, rejoining us is Juan Pablo Osornio, global climate political leader from Greenpeace, and also Bill Moyer, who's a climate change activist. All right, Juan, let me first ask you, according to various reports, global warming is caused by human activity and is rooted in a social and economic system that is based in capitalism. Materialistic tendencies, which are taught at an early age, which, as a consequence, drives factory production, hence contributing to climate change. How do you think that can be controlled, if it can?
I think it needs to be controlled for those that are responsible for our well-being. And for me, it's basic that the government is the one ultimately responsible for the well-being of their citizens, for their physical safety, for peace, for health. And they know things that the general public wouldn't know. In other words, what needs to happen is that states need to come in, and there needs to be an agreement or law where you're not allowed to trade or to profit from things that are needed for the safety and the well-being of your citizens.
All right, Bill, what do you think? Is there any hope when it comes to consumerism and, of course, capitalism as a whole and its impact on climate change?
Well, I think that we began to talk about this. The problem is that policies and politics follow culture. We have to find ways to reconnect to the places that we live. We need to, like in where I live, salmon are an important species. They're important economically, but they're important as as a central species for the indigenous cultures of this place. Salmon are also an amazing example of the abundance of nature when humans get out of the way. We need to get out of the way.
All right. I'd like to thank both of our guests. That was Bill Moyer there, climate change activist, and also Juan Pablo Osornio, the climate political leader at Greenpeace, both of them with great contributions there. Right now it's time to see how climate change could actually hit the financial system and the very financial institutions that are behind the banks and behind the Fortune 500 companies, and they should think twice for giving them more credit or lending them more money. I wish there was a solution to offer you in my final thoughts as to how we can reduce climate change to zero. But right there, that is the wrong approach. Climate change cannot be reduced to zero. But something can be done to reduce the Earth's warming. For starters, green energy transformation needs to be fully executed, like solar energy. Green energy in the form of electric cars is also another idea. Obviously, that's being currently executed. But consumerism is part of that equation, meaning the capitalistic society that remains under doubt as to whether that can be changed. How can anyone convince these multinationals to not produce as much and for us not to buy as much? I mean, they have shareholders that they have to respond to, and ultimately they need the sales. Who can change that when in Western countries people are brought up to follow and buy and purchase? The pattern obviously is to buy, to work, and to keep buying, which is what societies are built on. That is the challenge. Thanks for joining us in this edition of Economic Divide. It's a pleasure having you on board this program. Any questions or comments, do send them to us. From Mika Vitale, it's goodbye. Until next time.
the limelight.
There has been a rapid increase in the number of American children receiving COVID-19 diagnoses over the past month, a disturbing trend being witnessed across the country as kids head back to school. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Chris Walker, journalist. This article is published under the heading U.S. Child COVID Diagnosis Surpass 500,000 Just as Schools Start Reopening. Stay tuned for more. There has been a rapid increase in the number of American children receiving COVID-19 diagnoses over the past month, a disturbing trend being witnessed across the country as kids head back to school. The American Academy of Pediatrics reported that between August 5th to 26th, more than 500,000 children received a positive diagnosis of coronavirus. That's a significant rise compared to months prior. Indeed, for the single week of August 19th, there were over 203,000 positive tests identified among children, a substantially higher number than the 8,500 cases reported during an earlier one-week study done in June. The alarming trend has health experts worried, and many are renewing calls for school districts to require masks for children, especially for those who are under the age of 12, as they are as yet ineligible for the vaccinations to protect against COVID. The virus is raging in all of these children who are unvaccinated, which is why in schools, mask mandates are so important. They have no other protection, said CNN medical analyst Jonathan Rayner, adding, they're literally sitting ducks. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, has recommended that every school district in the country implement masking and social distancing standards within school buildings to prevent the virus from spreading. A number of districts across the U.S. have instituted such rules, but many have not. And a number of states with Republican governors have actually banned districts from being able to do so even if they want to. The situation is becoming dire for children in many of those states, particularly because this round of COVID, which includes the Delta variant of the virus, seems to be affecting children more than it did a year ago. In Texas, several hospitals have reported that they have zero pediatric ICU hospital beds available because of the spike in COVID infections among children. Florida is facing similar challenges, and as a result of increases in COVID numbers, at least two school districts have already had to close their doors until next week. As the number of coronavirus diagnoses among children increases, more evidence about the efficacy of masks to prevent its spread is becoming available. A randomized controlled study in Bangladesh, for instance, found a 9.3% reduction of coronavirus diagnoses when just 7 in 25 individuals in the study were masking up. That, on its own, is an encouraging statistic, but the effectiveness of masking would be many times greater if it were near universal, one of the study's authors said. I think this should basically end any scientific debate about whether masks can be effective in combating COVID at a population level. Jason Abalak, an economist at Yale University who was involved in the study, told the Washington Post. However, in spite of the recent studies and others like it showing near definitive proof that masking is an effective way to prevent the spread of coronavirus, proponents of state mask mandate bans are digging their heels in insisting that they have a right to ban such rules from being enforced at a local level. Florida Education Department Commissioner Richard Crocon, discussing a lawsuit brought by parents against the state's mask mandate ban, said his department would appeal the decision in the near future. Crocon said to Fox News, "I'm very confident they are going to rule on our side because what we are doing is absolutely within the Constitution, within the law." Yet, in a ruling to which Crocon is referring to, Leon County Circuit Judge John Cooper said the school districts were following the law as their actions didn't infringe on the fundamental rights of a parent, as the legislation states. The law, which was enacted in June with Governor Ron DeSantis' signature, says that districts cannot make decisions for students that affect their upbringing, education, healthcare choices, and mental health without demonstrating that such action is reasonable and necessary to achieve a compelling state interest. In making his ruling recently, Cooper noted that the state failed to show how masking rules were unreasonable, while pointing out that the ban was violating the same parents' Bill of Rights that it was aiming to enforce. Cooper said, "My ruling in this case, if you want to put it in one sentence, is I am enforcing the bill passed by the legislature and requiring that anyone who uses that bill to follow all provisions and not part of the provisions."
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. Please accept our condolences on the arrival of the month of Muharram and the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali about the Master of the Martyrs, Sayyid al-Shuhada, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Stay tuned.
تو کاشان، شاید یه چیزی حدود 70 سال پیش، یه میرزا حبیب الله کاشانی بود که کتاباش
Around 70 years ago in the city of Kashan in Iran, there was a man by the name of Mirza Habibullah Kashani whose profession was recalling the tragedies of Karbala and reciting lamentations for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Since he was great in this profession, his time was full during the month of Muharram, and he was present at different majalis for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Once, an old lady stopped him on the street and asked him to come and host the majlis of Imam al-Hussein for 10 days in her house. Mirza Habibullah was very much busy and gave a time to the lady which she thought she would not accept. That was 2 p.m., which is not considered a good time to hold the majlis for the guests and the neighbors. Finally, he accepted going to the old lady's majlis and recited a few words of lamentations and left the majlis soon.
Karbala, as I step onto your sand, you capture my eyes. Karbala, I see heaven has been placed beneath your skies.
Toshod Ruza Ashura.
The day of Ashura came, and Mirza Habibullah was busy, so he forgot to tell the old lady that he cannot attend her session on that day. It was near the noon that he became tired and took a nap. In his dreams, he saw a lady who introduced herself as Fatima, the mother of Hussein. In his dream, Hazrat Fatima asked the man not to forget the majlis of the old lady for Imam al-Hussein. Upon seeing this, he woke up and ran to the house of the old lady, where he found the old lady anxious about Mirza being late. Upon reaching her, Mirza was told by the old lady, "Where are you, Mirza? Hazrat Fatimatu Zahra is waiting for the majlis for her son Abu Abdullah al-Hussein." The main lesson that we take from this event is that the main hosts for the majalis of Imam al-Hussein are the members of the Ahl al-Bayt themselves. Prophet Muhammad, Imam Ali alayhi salam, Hazrat Fatima Zahra, and other respected members of the Ahl al-Bayt.
Karbala, why do you hold such memories? Ashura, always full of mysteries. Ashura, always full of mysteries.
Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Fi amanallah.
Beginning, the season's tears are flowing. Our Imam, we are condoling. Our new year starts with morning. Muharram is a beginning. The season's tears are flowing. Our Imam, we Karbala, what precious blood was spilled there? Ashura, al-Hussein was murdered.
In the limelight.
Report finds extreme weather has killed more than 2 million people and cost $3.64 trillion in economic damages since 1970. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jenna Maguire, journalist. This article is published under the heading Climate-Driven Weather Disasters Increased Fivefold Over Past 50 Years, UN Agency says. Please stay tuned for the details of this article. The number of extreme weather disasters driven by the climate crisis has increased fivefold over the past 50 years, killing more than 2 million people and costing $3.64 trillion in total losses, a United Nations agency said recently. The World Meteorological Organization, WMO, says its Atlas report is the most comprehensive review of mortality and economic losses from extreme climate and weather incidents ever produced. It surveyed some 11,000 events between 1970 and 2019. The report highlights major catastrophes such as Ethiopia's 1983 drought, the single most fatal event with 300,000 deaths, and Hurricane Katrina in 2005, which was the most economically costly with losses of $163.6 billion. The report finds that from 1970 to 2019, weather, climate, and water hazards accounted for 50% of all disasters, 45% of all reported deaths, and 74% of all reported economic losses. The number of weather, climate, and water extremes are increasing and will become more frequent and severe in many parts of the world as a result of climate change, said WMO Secretary General Petteri Talas, adding, "That means more heat waves, droughts, and forest fires such as those we have observed recently in Europe and North America. We have more water vapor in the atmosphere, which is exacerbating extreme rainfall and deadly flooding. The warming of the oceans has affected the frequency and area of existence of the most intense tropical storms." The report finds that more than 91% of the 2 million deaths occurred in developing countries where there is weaker infrastructure and warning systems. The leading cause of death was drought, followed by storms, floods, and extreme temperatures. While deaths from extreme weather events have decreased almost threefold from 1970 to 2019 due to improved disaster reporting, economic losses are rapidly skyrocketing. According to the report, economic losses have increased sevenfold, surging from $175.4 billion in 1970s to $1.38 trillion in 2010s. An average of $220 million in damage occurred every day from 1970 to 2019. Storms being the most prevalent cause of damage, resulting in the largest economic losses around the globe. Three of the costliest 10 disasters occurred in 2017. Hurricanes Harvey, $96.9 billion. Maria, $69.4 billion. And Irma, $58.2 billion. The report reveals crucial lessons from the past 50 years and makes a number of recommendations to governments, including review hazard exposure and vulnerability considering a changing climate to reflect that tropical cyclones may have different tracks, intensity, and speed than in the past. Strengthen disaster risk financing mechanism at national to international levels, especially for least developed countries and small island developing states and territories, and develop integrated and proactive policies on a slow onset disaster such as drought. More lives are being saved thanks to early warning systems, but it is also true that the number of people exposed to disaster risk is increasing due to population growth in hazard-exposed areas and the growing intensity and frequency of weather events, said Mami Mistori, Special Representative of the Secretary General for Disaster Risk Reduction and Head of UN Office for Disaster Risk Reduction. More international cooperation is needed to tackle the chronic problem of huge numbers of people being displaced each year by floods, storms, and drought, Missouri added, saying, "We need greater investments in comprehensive disaster risk management, ensuring that climate change adaptation is integrated in national and local disaster risk reduction strategies."
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Weeks after the Taliban swept to power in Afghanistan, the world is still evaluating the results of the West's 20-year-long war in the country. The United States have faced criticism over its messy withdrawal from Afghanistan and its achievements in the Central Asian country. The unexpectedly rapid fall of the Afghan capital, the scenes of chaos at the Kabul International Airport where hundreds of people desperate to leave the country had gathered, and the bomb attack claimed by the Daesh terror group that killed over 170 people, including 13 U.S. troops, have all raised questions about the U.S. military superiority. That's an issue British Defense Secretary Ben Wallace raised in an interview with The Spectator magazine.
It's obvious that Britain is not a superpower, but a superpower that is also not prepared to stick at something isn't probably a superpower either. It is certainly not a global force, it's just a big power.
This wasn't the first time that the British Defense Secretary has criticized Washington, a close UK ally. Back in August, he said former US President Donald Trump's decision to clinch a deal with the Taliban was a mistake.
I would say if it's a superpower or not is pretty irrelevant. The United States is still the greatest danger facing the world and the greatest concentration of private power against our species that has ever existed.
While the U.S. threatens military action against nations it deems its adversaries, including Iran, Russia, and China, it appears that more Washington allies are beginning to take up the opinion that America has lost its superpower status.
Good afternoon.
Earlier this year, U.S. President Joe Biden announced the August 31st deadline for the withdrawal of American troops from Afghanistan as a means to uphold the 2020 deal reached between former President Donald Trump's administration and the Taliban in the Qatari capital, Doha. But the withdrawal of American forces from the country meant that all U.S. allies had to follow suit, regardless of whether they intended to do so, as they depended on U.S. logistics and air support, as well as a safe evacuation of their citizens. The developments in recent weeks have reignited the debate about the formation of a European Rapid Response Force.
And I think it's clear that the need for more European defense has never been as much as evident as today after the events in Afghanistan. Sometimes something happens that pushes the history. It creates a breakthrough. And I think that the Afghanistan events of this summer is one of these cases.
The EU has been working on that. It was positioned for us 4 years ago as, well, Trump is an unreliable ally. See what he's doing. He's driving the Europeans to do this. But as a matter of fact, that project was under construction before Trump.
In an interview earlier this year, German Defense Minister Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer questioned the bloc's strategic autonomy from the United States. Her comments drew fierce criticism from French President Emmanuel Macron, who believes in the bloc's so-called strategic autonomy.
You know, Europe, with its colonial history, it's certainly, you know, not good news to find out that they're building a new army of their own again, because that has never meant anything good for the people in the rest of the world. But the fact that there is maybe another challenger being lifted up and presented to Washington, that's, I think, a healthy development.
But the question now is what it will take for the European U.S. allies to turn their ideas into action and seek independence from Washington.
Venezuela's main opposition parties have announced an end to 3 years of boycotting elections. The country's opposition alliance, the so-called Democratic Unity Roundtable, which is led by the U.S.-sponsored opposition figure Juan Guaido, announced on Tuesday that it would participate in the regional and municipal elections scheduled for November 21. President Nicolas Maduro has praised the move as worthy of applause for returning to democracy. The opposition, however, said its participation would not mean that it believed the elections would be free or fair. The alliance boycotted the 2018 presidential vote, which Maduro won, and the 2020 legislative elections, in which the opposition lost control of Congress. In both cases, it dismissed the elections as fraudulent. Its decision to end the boycott comes as government and opposition representatives are involved in talks, mediated by Norway and hosted by Mexico. The talks, which began last month, are aimed at resolving the political crisis that plagued the Latin American country after Guaido unilaterally declared himself interim president in January 2019. Back in 2019, Guaido proclaimed himself the interim president of Venezuela. Back then, the administration of former President Donald Trump, along with several European countries and a number of right-wing Latin American leaders, recognized Guaido as Venezuela's interim president. The U.S. confiscated Venezuelan state assets in America in a bid to support Guaido.
They were doing things that really were undermining the autonomy and the sovereignty of Venezuela to have its own free and fair elections, and were committing acts which they had no right under any sort of international law to do. And so it just is a matter of time before the failure of all these events catches up to the United States and the Venezuelan opposition who it was working with.
The U.S. move was seen as an attempt to topple the legitimate government of Venezuela. That was not the first time the U.S. pushed for regime change in Venezuela. Back in 2002, during the presidency of George W. Bush, a coup was orchestrated against Venezuela's former president Hugo Chavez. The plot failed due to overwhelming popular support and mobilization against the coup. Washington has a long list of military interventions and coups in different Latin American countries. Venezuela is now one of the few countries in that region which is led by a left-wing anti-imperialist government. The U.S. push to oust Maduro's government is reminiscent of U.S. colonial moves in Latin America during the 20th century. The Food Assistance Agency of the UN has estimated that one out of every three Venezuelan is struggling to consume enough daily calories.
The United States has fully withdrawn its forces from Afghanistan to officially end 20 years of occupation. The invasion will be remembered for its colossal failures, unfulfilled promises, and a frantic final exit that cost the lives of scores of Afghan civilians and 13 US military personnel. The final US evacuation flight left Kabul Airport late on Monday. US military officials say hundreds of Americans who have been left on Afghan soil will be transported out of the country in the coming days. A Taliban spokesman says the defeat of the United States in Afghanistan was a lesson for the invaders.
The withdrawal of foreign forces is a big achievement for the Afghans and their independence. It is the day of good lesson for the aggressors that they shouldn't have invaded Afghanistan.
More than 122,000 people have reportedly been evacuated from Kabul since August the 14th, the day before the Taliban took control of the country. U.S. President Joe Biden has come under immense criticism of his handling of the withdrawal. Nearly 90 retired U.S. generals and admirals have called for Pentagon Chief Lloyd Austin and Joint Chiefs Chairman General Mark Milley to resign for their roles surrounding the chaotic pullout. The retired flag officers proposed what they felt should have happened in the withdrawal, including not rushing the pullout and not abandoning the Bagram airbase and American weapons and military equipment in the hands of the Taliban.
The war in Afghanistan is now over. I'm the fourth president who has faced the issue of whether and when to end this war. When I was running for president, I made a commitment to the American people that I would end this war. Today, I've honored that commitment. It was time to be honest with the American people again.
Well, I don't believe the U.S. government has learned a lesson. The U.S. media certainly hasn't learned a lesson. Statements we've seen from Biden, for instance, have been that we've accomplished our goals in Afghanistan, which I think is furthest from the truth.
The U.S. invaded Afghanistan in 2001 following the 9/11 attacks under the pretext of so-called war on terror. According to estimates, America's longest war took the lives of nearly 2,500 U.S. troops and an estimated 240,000 Afghans, and cost around $2 trillion U.S. dollars. Thousands of Afghan civilians were also maimed during the years. The estimated interest costs of the war are expected to top $6.5 trillion by 2050.
I think the U.S. went in there 20 years ago, removed the Taliban, and now the Taliban is back, perhaps stronger than ever. It seems like it's an utter defeat for the United States.
The war has left Afghanistan in ruins and devastated the country's infrastructure. Just as Saigon marked the humiliating defeat of U.S. geostrategic ambitions in Indochina after 10 years of war and conflict in Vietnam, many analysts now believe Kabul marks the same humiliating defeat in Central Asia.
You know, after the Vietnam War, there was something they called the Vietnam Syndrome. The American people didn't want to go into that kind of war ever again. And I believe we're seeing the beginning of an Afghan syndrome. The American people think it was a mistake, don't want to see it again. The trillions of dollars that went into Afghanistan could have been used to help the Afghani people or for the American people.
The botched military occupation is likely to trigger a refugee crisis in the Middle East and beyond. When it comes to Afghanistan and the wider region, Washington and its allies have proved after two decades that they have nothing to offer but misery and despair. U.S. officials believed that a U.S.-trained, funded, and equipped Afghan army could hold the line against the poorly trained, funded, and equipped Taliban insurgency. But after a 20-year presence in Afghanistan, they still had little or no understanding of Afghan society and the power of Taliban militants.
Hundreds of Palestinians have staged protests against the Israeli regime's inhumane blockade of the Gaza Strip, burning tires and hurling explosive devices toward the fence between Gaza and the occupied territories for several consecutive nights. The Israeli military, which deployed additional troops along the fence ahead of the night protests, used live fire, tear gas, and stun grenades against Palestinian protesters. Several Palestinians have been injured by Israeli forces east of the Gaza Strip. The Palestinian Health Ministry's spokesman, Ashraf Al-Kedra, said several others were hurt from tear gas canisters fired at them. During Saturday night's protests alone, 11 Palestinians were injured by live fire and other aggressive measures used by Israeli forces.
I mean, it's because the laws are not being implemented, they're not being penalized, they're not being punished for all these violations of all these laws. So they feel like they have a green light to commit more crimes and more crimes. And this becomes a natural system for the Zionists. The Zionists now, they think that they're above the law, and no law is going to stop them from committing any crime that they want to do. And that's why you can see that whenever we hear condemnations from countries or even the nation's assemblies, there's nothing really coming out of it at the end of the day.
Gazans have been organizing protests since last week. They are demanding that the crossings be reopened to facilitate the entry of goods and humanitarian aid. In a statement on Sunday, the resistance committees in Palestine announced that the protests will continue until the Israeli regime lifts its siege. The Palestinians say the Israeli regime's repeated attacks on the positions of the resistance in Gaza would not dissuade them from fighting for their freedom and dignity. Over the Israeli regime's tight blockade, which now includes deliberate hampering of efforts to reconstruct the strip following its latest war on Gaza. Back in May, the Israeli military bombarded the besieged Gaza Strip for 11 consecutive days, killing at least 260 Palestinians, including 66 children. The Gaza-based resistance groups fired around 4,000 rockets towards the Israeli-occupied territories during the 11-day war, forcing Tel Aviv to call for a ceasefire.
The only way it really works with this particular regime, and this illegitimate regime, the Zionist regime, is by righteous, unified resistance, and that's exactly what we want to see in Palestine.
Amid the ongoing confrontations, Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas and Israeli Minister for Military Affairs Benny Gantz met in Ramallah on Sunday, marking the highest level meeting held between the two sides in over a decade. The two discussed issues related to diplomacy, economics, and civil affairs, according to a statement from Gantz's office.
You know, it's quite clear that the Zionist regime does not want peace and does not want to recognize the Palestinians because they had a chance many times. You can see that they're still stealing, areas in the West Bank, and that's obviously international law breaches. We can see now, Sheikh Jarrah, Sinwan, all these different areas, even in Jerusalem and different areas, they're still, evicting, stealing people's homes in a very, very barbaric way.
The Palestinian resistance groups have pledged not to allow the Israeli regime to continue its aggression against the Palestinian people or change the rules of engagement.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
Military contractor CACI International noted repeatedly that U.S. withdrawal from the 20-year Afghanistan war harmed the company's profits. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Sarah Lazar Ryder. This article is published under the heading Military contractor CACI says Afghanistan withdrawal is hurting its profits. It's funding a pro-war think tank. Stay tuned for more. On August 12th, the military contractor CACI International Corporation told its investors that the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan is hurting its profits. The same contractor is also funding a think tank that is concurrently arguing against the withdrawal. This case is worth examining both because it is routine and because it highlights the venality of expert military contractor feedback loop in which private companies use think tanks to rally support for wars they will profit from. The contractor is notorious to those who have followed the scandal of U.S.-led torture in Iraq. CACI International was sued by three Iraqis formerly detained in Abu Ghraib prison who charged that the company's employees are responsible for directing their torture, including sexual abuse and electric shocks. The suit was brought in 2008 and the case is still ongoing. In 2019, CACI International was awarded a nearly $907 million five-year contract to provide intelligence operations and analytic support for the U.S. Army in Afghanistan. During an August 12th earnings call, CACI International noted repeatedly that U.S. withdrawal from the 20-year Afghanistan war harmed the company's profits. John Mengucci, president and CEO of CACI International, said, "We have about a 2% headwind coming into FY 2022 because of Afghanistan. A headwind refers to negative impacts on profits." Afghanistan was mentioned 16 times throughout the call, either in reference to the dent in profits or to assure investors that other areas of growth were offsetting the losses. For example, Mengucci said we are seeing positive growth in technology and expected to continue to outpace expertise growth, collectively offsetting the impact of Afghanistan drawdown. Similar themes were repeated in an April 22nd earnings call, where the company lamented the headwinds posed by the Afghanistan withdrawal. Industry and defense publications have picked up on this theme, but framed it in the company's terms by emphasizing the offsets to its losses. Despite CACI International clear economic interest in continuing the war, on August 12th call, company officials were careful not to editorialize about the Biden administration's decision. The closest they came was a cautious statement from Mengucci. At least as of today, we have watched the administration make the decision to completely exit Afghanistan by 9/11, and all I can say is they are executing on that decision, unquote. But CACI International does not have to broadcast its positions on the war. Instead, it is funding a think tank that has been actively urging the administration not to leave Afghanistan. CACI International is listed as a corporate sponsor of the Institute for Study of War, which describes itself as a nonpartisan, nonprofit public policy research organization. Dr. Warren Phillips, lead director of CACI International, is on the board of the think tank. Other funders include General Dynamics and Microsoft. When it comes to the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, however, the think tank is extremely partisan. Jack Kinn, a retired four-star general and board member of the Institute for Study of War, meanwhile, has been on a cable news blitz arguing against the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, as reported by Ryan Grimm, Sarah Sirota, Lee Fang, and Rose Adams for The Intercept. The Intercept noted CACI's international backing of the think tank. Kimberly Kagan, founder and president of the Institute for the Study of War, told Fox News on August 17th that the U.S. withdrawal could cause Afghanistan to become the second school of jihadism. She warned, "It is not clear that the Taliban, which seeks international recognition and legitimacy, is going to want to tolerate or encourage direct attacks on the U.S. from Al-Qaeda or other groups based in Afghanistan." The think tank's backing from a military contractor was not discussed in these media appearances. The case of CACI International is not unique. The Intercept notes, among other talking heads who took to cable news segments or op-ed pages without disclosing their defense industry ties, were retired General David Petraeus, Rebecca Grant, a former staffer for the Air Force Secretary, Richard Haass, who worked as an advisor to then Secretary of State Colin Powell, and former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. This cacophony of voices matters because Biden is facing a media uproar over the withdrawal. Pundits and mainstream press outlets that have been ignoring civilian death for years are suddenly expressing moral outrage at their hardships now that the war is ending. While there are legitimate concerns about the fate of Afghans as the Taliban seizes control, the vast majority of the firestorm stems from a reflexively pro-war perspective, in favor of the indefinite extension of an occupation that has proven brutal and lethal for civilians. The overwhelming effect is to send the message to the administration and any future presidents that they should think twice before completely withdrawing from a war, lest they have a media revolt on their hands. But this outcry didn't materialize out of nowhere. Think Tank Express, whose organizations are financed by the very companies profiting from the war, play a key part. They're trotted out in front of cameras and quoted in major media outlets, presented as above-the-fray observers. They're well-financed, polished, and groomed precisely for moments like these. And the companies financing them get to launder their own objectives through institutions that are seen as respectable, academic, and rigorous. It's a grotesque system that is functioning as it was designed. In its August 12th call, CACI International simply acknowledged the company's economic interests out loud.
چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خداست، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. Dear brothers and sisters, you are listening to The Spring of Truth from IRIB English Radio. In this special episode, we select a short part of Imam Khomeini's will. Selfish people and oppressors exploited the Holy Quran, introduced deviation from the religion of God and the divine book and tradition. The Holy Quran, the book which was descended as the complete and the seal of revelation to the Prophet Muhammad in order to enhance the people of the world, to establish justice and equity, and to entrust governance to men of Allah, the infallibles, from the first to the last, so that they would entrust it to whomever served the interest of humanity, was removed from the scene to the extent that it seems it never had any role to play to guiding humanity.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitan rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And you are listening to Spring of Truth coming to you from IRIB English Radio. So stay tuned with us. I am your host, Abdullah Al Musawi, an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qom. We are looking at Imam Khomeini's point of view when it comes to Ashura. Imam Khomeini was quoted saying, "Lamentation for the martyrs means the preservation and perpetuation of the movement. The Shia, when they show condolences and renew this bereavement, they also learn great lessons from it. When we cry for Imam Hussein and when we lament for him, it's not a matter of just us crying. It's there are more lessons to be derived. From Karbala, we learn to stand against oppression, to join justice, to be courageous, to stand for freedom, to speak our thoughts, to bring our morals to the outside, to enjoin good, to forbid evil, to stand with the truth, to sacrifice ourselves for the truth itself. And so many lessons to be learned and derived. So crying for Imam al-Hussein salamullah alayhi is not a matter of just me shedding tears. As in fact, there is a huge love that I have for the Imam that drives me towards these beautiful meanings and these beautiful moral traits that the Imam himself fought for and stood for. Yes, it begins as an emotional outcry for the Imam himself. But that outcry itself, not only for the Imam, salamullah alayhi, but in fact for everything that he stood for.